You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
By June 1971, over 50,000 Americans had died in Vietnam. Despite years of unprecedented news coverage, Americans were able to discover they knew far less about the war than they had supposed, but only after one of the great constitutional fights in U.S. history, a fight that's echoed today in the WikiLeaks debate and the Obama administration's prosecutions of whistleblowers. Former New York Times lawyer James Goodell tells the story of the newspaper's legal battle to publish the government's secret history of the Vietnam War in his book, Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. It's published by the CUNY Journalism Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Goodell to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
You first learned that the New York Times had a huge story on its hands at the Gridiron Club in March 1971.
Well, the Gridiron Club.
That's a casual place to learn such a story.
You know, you got to picture the Gridiron Club as a place for the greats of the world. While I'm a great today, X years ago, I was not great. So I was overawed by being there. And that's where presidents attack the press and the press attack presidents. And there are chairmen of the boards, there are journalists and so forth and so on. And one of the greats, Max Frankel, had me at his table. I didn't know why I was there, actually, because I shouldn't have been there. But he said, "Have you heard? We have some classified documents." And that's where it all started. He never told me anything more until much, much later.
How much material did the Times have at the time? All of it?
Actually, at the time that Max talked to me, I've reconstructed the facts. Max hardly had anything. It was a couple of chapters that were circulating in the anti-war movement, not only in Washington, D.C., but in Boston, Mass. But I didn't know that. Eventually, someone came into my office with a huge supermarket, you know, one of those push carts, and the things went practically to the ceiling. And then I knew they had everything because that was a lot.
Well, that was also a lot of Xeroxing today. That's the pre-digital world.
That's right. Definitely pre-digital.
And when did people start calling them the Pentagon Papers?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think as soon as the case started, you may remember, there was a case that got the name, the Pentagon Papers case, that started because Nixon wanted to censor the press, and it was the biggest news story of a couple of weeks, and I think the press dubbed it, shall we say, the Pentagon Papers. It was easier to say than what it really was.
Well, they had been compiled during the Johnson administration. What reason?
That's right. That's a strange thing because Nixon was upset about something that said really nothing about Nixon and everything about Johnson.
And I would have thought that Nixon, being the clever man he was, would have seen this as giving him a political advantage, not something that he would want to suppress.
Well, I've got this scene where the first issue comes out, and his daughter got married the day before.
And hadn't that been the big story?
And that was a big story. And someone called him, "Have you heard about this?" And he said, "No, because all he'd been reading was his daughter's story," and he's just passed it off. And then, his subordinates kept calling him and got him really worked up.
Well, what were the most significant revelations that were included in the Pentagon Papers?
Well, I think that, generally speaking, the revelations were the lies that the administration after administration had told the American public about our role in Vietnam. There was something called the Geneva Accords. People have forgotten about them. They provided for elections. But I didn't know that. The American people didn't know that. They thought Vietnam, North Vietnam, had invaded South Vietnam. President Johnson, for example, ran for president in 1964. And he said he would never bring the war. He would never bomb Vietnam. And lo and behold, the Pentagon Papers showed he'd actually made plans for that. So it showed lie after lie, deception after deception. Another one, for example, was the Tonkin Gulf incident. People have forgotten about it now, but that was the excuse we used to rev up the war. In fact, the paper showed that the government had induced the North Vietnamese to attack the Americans in the Tonkin Gulf. So lie after lie after lie, and it really made you sort of sick at your stomach.
And going back many administrations, Eisenhower was the president when the elections were scheduled to be held, and the United States kind of stopped that because we knew that Ho Chi Minh was going to win.
Yeah. Well, we had this idea that anyone who was a communist was a mortal enemy of the United States, and if one country went down in Southeast Asia, it was dominoes, they'd all go down. It was paranoia in retrospect.
Well, did Nixon really believe that the United States could still win in Southeast Asia? This is kind of late in the war, and the public had pretty much turned on the war.
Yeah, I think that he did, and I think that part of his anger was directed at those who thought he couldn't, such as the Vietnam protesters. Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, and he became the most dangerous man in America, I think in some part because all these people were telling me he couldn't win, and he vented his anger at them.
My guest is James C. Goodale, G-O-O-D-A-L-E. His book, Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. What's prompted you to tell this story now, over 40 years after the events?
There were two things, Leonard. I think an impelling force was WikiLeaks, because the WikiLeaks leak was the greatest leak that we've had in this country since the Pentagon Papers, and I wanted to have a chance to look at the two of them. And then the second thing was, I was intrigued by the allegations the government had made during the case in which they said, and the Supreme Court agreed in some part, we, the New York Times, had damaged national security. But nonetheless, the court held the First Amendment trumped such damage. And I wanted to take a look back and see if they were shooting straight or not in the light of history. That's what history's for.
Well, had the Pentagon Papers done any damage? It's been argued that WikiLeaks really hasn't done any damage except embarrassing a lot of people.
Well, I think it may be easier to say the former than the latter, but I would agree with both statements. Well, here's the thing. You go back and look at this case. It's a secret case. That's part of the intrigue of this for me. The case was held substantially in secret, so the public never knew what went on in the case, and I had to go through all the secret records and ask myself, did this so-called secret in fact damage national security? I was giving the government the benefit of the doubt. I got three-quarters of the way through. I said, holy God, I can't believe it. This case is a farce. There is not one piece of evidence that shows that one dotted I, one cross T in 2 million words ever came close to damaging national security.
Well, you write that you think anything can be published. What do you mean by that? Even plans for making a bomb or instructing people on how to become suicide bombers?
But what I say in there is if you're a good publishing lawyer, you can take material from any writer, and you can mold it in a fashion to make it publishable. So I start off with the idea anything can be published, but that's not to say, as a matter of law, anything can be published, because if you believe that, you're known as a First Amendment absolutist. Anything goes. I'm not. I think that there are exceptions to the First Amendment, so if I were I lost control of this publication, but if I had, by the way, but if I had my way at the beginning, I would have molded it by putting something here, putting something there, and leaving out something, you know, the whole 10 yards.
What do you mean you lost control?
Well, I was only 12 years old then. I was 37 then. That's young for a mature organization where everyone in power is a generation older than you. And while I advised from the very beginning, and I did at the end, that the First Amendment would protect publication, I was met with fierce resistance from the former Attorney General of the United States, Herbert Brownell, the former president of the City Bar Association, Louis Loeb, whom had been called by the upper uppers to get their opinion. My opinion apparently didn't matter. And
you were just a kid lawyer.
I was just a kid lawyer, and no one was paying any attention to me. Not. Would they rather listen to the Attorney General of the United States? I couldn't understand why that was. So that's how I lost control of it.
Well, do you, by the way, do you share the beliefs you had in 1971, or have your opinions deepened over the years?
With respect to?
What should be published and what can't be, how that might apply to the current situation.
Yeah.
Bradley Manning and Julian Assange.
Writing this book was an experience for me that sharpened up my views. I think that's what writing does. Every writer will tell you you're better off in your mind for doing it than not. And when I came to the conclusion that there wasn't anything in there that could possibly damage national security, I've become a hardliner on the left on this. And if somebody tells me, as indeed the Attorney General of the United States said last week or 2 weeks ago, that the AP leak was the worst he'd ever seen in his life, I look at him and I said, I just don't believe it. So my views with respect to the issue in the Pentagon Papers case have hardened. I just don't believe what the government tells me anymore.
But this is a fight that we see again and again in our history.
Yes.
And part of it has to do with the fact that I don't think there's been a president who's liked the press and liked the fact that they can't control the flow of news.
Yes.
Democrat, Republican,
right.
If we had a socialist or if we had a fascist, they'd all feel the same way.
Yes, I think that's probably good for the country. You know, so you have two forces up against each other and colliding. And why should the government like the press? They're criticizing them. But here's the thing with Nixon, and who knows, maybe with Obama too. Nixon took it to a different level, because what he did was he not only said he didn't like the press, okay, but he used legal action to reflect his views of the press. He sued the New York Times when he ran for election in 1968. He sued the Times to get information from its reporter. He really sued the reporter. He sued the Times to stop it from publication. So he was a lawyer who thought that legal action could carry out his views of the press. I think that's pretty much different in American history.
Well, we have the current president applying a law that goes back to World War I, and Nixon had wanted to apply that law as well, hadn't he?
Well, this law is called the Espionage Act. John Mitchell was Attorney General for President Nixon. He found this law that no one thought could possibly apply to the press. Why? It's called espionage. Now, what's espionage? Espionage is not when I tell you something, Leonard, that I've got that's classified. It's when I go and tell the enemy, Al-Qaeda, you know, what I have. There's a difference. So no one ever thought it applied. And what happened
was... But when you publish something, aren't you telling Al-Qaeda?
No. I'm telling you. I'm not telling Al-Qaeda. I mean...
On the air.
On the air.
There are Al-Qaeda listeners.
I have
a very large contingent of Al-Qaeda listeners.
Well, of course, anything that's published will end up on the computer or the intelligence base of whomever it is you are dealing with. But it's different from intending to commit espionage than saying, here I'm telling the press what's going on, and that applies to a leaker, too.
Well, pretty much every politician says, I believe in transparency, and then they start talking about what can't be revealed, and everything becomes a danger to the rest of us. All of our lives are endangered.
Well, every president does that, I would suggest, because every president, and whether it's president of IBM or president of United States, wants to control the flow of information, because if you control the flow of information, that's power. And if you're the president of the United States and you could put a classified stamp or a top secret stamp on all that information, that you want to control, it gives you extra power. So they're all the same in that regard.
Had you served in the military?
I have served in the military.
So did that influence your take on the story at the time?
It did, because I served in a strategic intelligence unit, if I can name drop here, with Steve Rockefeller, who was the son of the governor. And you know what I was doing? I was writing many Pentagon papers. So I'm not going to tell you what they are, because I don't believe in leaking myself. I believe in publishing leaks, but not leaking. So I wrote these many strategic intelligence analyses. And guess what they were based on? Mostly the New York Times. And then I reached for my stamp, because everyone had a stamp, and it said secret, and I went, wham. And I classified it secret. And that very much influenced my attitude toward the Pentagon paper, because they were pretty much the same.
My guest is James C. Goodell, who was the chief counsel for the New York Times during the Pentagon Papers case. And now he has written a book called Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles, expanding it to even today. It is published by CUNY. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with James C. Goodell. His book, Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles, published by CUNY Journalism Press. When did you find out that it was Daniel Ellsberg who was the source of all of this information?
No one's ever told me to this day.
Really?
No.
So you just read it in the paper like everybody else?
Well, when he came up to me and talking and started talking as though he was the person who leaked, I figured that was him.
But he had been pretty much protected, wasn't he, in the same way that Deep Throat was protected?
Oh, heavens, yes. You know, sources at publications with stories like this are heavily protected. And the editors knew who he was, but I didn't have any idea during the whole case, and as I say, for many years after, that he was the person. I thought it was probable that some anti-war activists had broken into the State Department and emptied the files out.
Well, wouldn't it have been important for you as the lawyer representing the New York Times to have known some of the details?
Yeah, it would have been important. And in some cases, in other instances, one did, I did. But I tell you, this thing went on its own momentum. As I point out in the book, Ellsberg didn't give Sheehan permission to publish till about 3 days before he did. So, and then there was a publication, then there was the lawsuit. And once that lawsuit started, I mean, forget it. I had all my people in my law office doing my laundry. It was one of these totally all-consuming things. And indeed, I had some curiosity to figure out what went on, because so much was going on at once.
Well, you mentioned that other lawyers and legal experts were brought in, including Herbert Brunel.
Right.
And they didn't agree with you. Did the Times finally just go along with you, or were they forced to because they had no other option?
Well, it may have been it may have been the latter. As I said earlier, I gave First Amendment advice not once but twice just before publication, and because the uppers had kept me out, I thought, you know, everyone was talking to each other at the upper level. It turned out that was not the case. And when Nixon said he was going to see us in court the next day at 9, 10, or 11, it was 11 o'clock at night, and I called Herbert Brownell and said, I'll see you there. He said, no, you won't. And so off I went, thinking I was going to do it myself. Now, Leonard, you think I would tell you the rest of the story? Even though we're on a station promoting my book, I'm not, because my readers won't read the book if I tell them the story.
No, they're going to read the book. It's okay. The people at the top, the publisher, A.O. Yeah. Sulzberger, Abe Rosenthal, the managing editor, were rather conservative. Were they willing to go against their own political beliefs to publish these?
Well, I think
because Katharine Graham was faced with the same dilemma in Washington.
Well, I think that when we talk about the publisher of the New York Times, he's faced with losing his whole enterprise. I mean, the whole reputation of Times could go up in smoke if, in fact, the documents were forgeries, if, in fact, criminal prosecution followed. So one can certainly appreciate his conservatism. Now, I think with respect to Abe Rosenthal, who's a legendary figure in New York Times history, I would like to think that he became more conservative, like others, as he grew older. And I didn't think of him as being particularly conservative during this case. I mean, he was caught, talk about fighting for the press. He was fighting as hard as everyone else, anyone else.
Had you done other First Amendment work before this?
Well, not a lot. But I think that if you are I was general counsel of the Times. I think if you're general counsel of the Times, you're honor bound to the profession, to your own integrity, and to the First Amendment to know what the heck it is. And there had been cases that had come up raising the First Amendment. So I didn't have a big – I can't say I had a big First Amendment case in this period before the Pentagon Papers, but I was well-versed.
But the Times and the Nixon administration already had a semi-adversarial relationship. In 69, the Times reported on Nixon and Kissinger's secret bombing campaign in Cambodia, and Nixon didn't appreciate that.
Well, I should say there's two things going on that I didn't mention. I'll correct myself a little bit. The first thing is, unlike Obama, for whom I'm having less love as a First Amendment type, Nixon was out to destroy the press, and he had an attack dog who was his vice president, Spiro Agnew, attacking the press.
And he had an enemies list.
And he had him in. And it goes on and on and on, and he wanted to destroy the Brookings Institute and so forth and so on. So that would obviously raise your interest in the First Amendment. But the second thing, which I really neglected to mention in answering that question, we did have a First Amendment battle with Earl Caldwell that was going on at the same time, which I had forgotten when you asked me that question. And so that was a real introduction to the First Amendment. I think I may have slipped over it because it didn't involve the major, huge issues of the Pentagon Papers. But, you know, that Earl Caldwell case, which was a case in which they're trying to get sources from Earl Caldwell, a black reporter. That case is alive today as we speak. It came to life twice in the last 2 weeks.
Well, because of the AP story and then the Fox News story.
Yes.
But there are other similarities. We have Nixon was trying to get IRS audits of people who he disagreed with in the press. There were also threats of antitrust lawsuits.
Well,
Everything old is new again.
Yeah, everything old is new.
Did Nixon represent a marked departure from previous presidents, or was he just being bolder than the others?
Well, I think he's a marked departure because, look, here's a little story about Daniel Ellsberg. He went and saw his lawyer after the publication and said, where are they going to put me away? The lawyer went and looked at the law and, excuse me, he said, there's no law there, Dan, that applies to you, but then again, no one else has published 2 million words. But the point of my remark is that Nixon has created all the problems that we have today because he went into court after Caldwell, he went into court after the New York Times Pentagon Papers case, and we have WikiLeaks on the horizon. It all started with Nixon.
You mentioned that Jimmy Carter nominated Ted Sorensen, who had been one of Kennedy's closest advisors, to head the CIA, but that the nomination was nixed partly because of Sorensen's affidavit in support of publishing the papers.
Well, I asked him for that affidavit, and he was a good guy to give it. We asked for affidavits of that sort from a variety of public figures, including Cy Vance, who wouldn't. Mac Bundy, who was a close advisor to the president, who wouldn't. But Ted Sorensen did. And then when he came up for a confirmation hearing, the Congress said, no, you gave that affidavit. You're not going to be with us. But, of course, the Congress may have had appointments. He's going to be head of the CIA.
Now, the Times was already seeing itself as in competition with television news, wasn't it? It was important to have a story like this.
Well, I don't know if it did. I think the Times didn't think it was in competition with anybody.
Well, they probably should have thought that way.
They should have, yeah.
They won their case in the Supreme Court, but how close did they come to losing?
Well, I think that the Times got off to a good start in the case because they had four votes with in favor of publication. And they knew that ahead of time because there had been an earlier tiny ruling that indicated that. So you're looking for one, four plus one.
Sounds like today again.
Yeah, it's the same old thing. But there wasn't any Kennedy on the court there. So our strategy was to pick out the one person who would give us the vote. And we picked out Potter Stewart, and we directed our whole case at him to get his vote. So we actually got his, and we got Brennan and Marshall also.
You're right. You include a great deal of criticism of the press at the time. How do you think the press emerged from the battles with Nixon?
Well, I think very well. I think we went through a really wonderful period from that point in time, say the 70s, the 80s. And I think we're doing fine until Bush Jr. came in. And right now, I just think we're doing terribly.
Again, you think the press is just falling down on the job? Why? With newspapers, I realize there have been a lot of cutbacks, but newspapers also need things that will excite the public and sell newspapers. They're going through a rough time. You'd think that they would be looking for the kinds of stories.
Well,
that
I think
would
that,
be equivalent.
That generally speaking, the president wants to have good relations with the press. He's not out to destroy the press the way that Nixon was. But when it comes to the national security area, it's really very bad. I mean, this case of Rosen was the person who wanted the source of a leak to Fox News from a gentleman whose name was Kim, and that talked about North Korea nuclear plans. And he, Obama, or his Justice Department, went into court and said, Mr. Rosen is a co-conspirator. And everyone couldn't believe it because how can he be a co-conspirator? Espionage Act, as I explained earlier, applies to espionage. And it doesn't apply to reporters. Okay, the Espionage Act is thought to apply to Mr. Kim, but here you have a guy who's not subject to the Espionage Act who's going to be prosecuted for violating it through conspiracy. I mean, that is so bad, and I wrote my book in part to wake everybody up, to tell them that Obama was planning to do this in the WikiLeaks case, and then all of a sudden, it turns out he's already done it. So I say, if in fact he does it and succeeds, that's to say he indicts Julian Assange for a conspiracy, acting as a co-conspirator, not violating the Espionage Act.
But do you think Bradley Manning violated
Espionage
Act?
Oh, come on. We got two levels here. We got Bradley Manning, leaker, you know, he's subject to discipline. Then we've got you, Leonard, and others in the press who are leakees. Now, we're trying to protect these leakees, and all of a sudden, Obama's saying, hey, leakee, you're just as bad as the guy who's leaking to you. And I thought if that ever happened, Obama would earn his place in reverse history, so to speak. But now he's already done it, so I don't know whether he's tied with Nixon for worse or just ahead of him.
Well, I still don't understand why talking about North Korean missile plans is such a terrible thing. Revealing any of that. It just seems to me part of the stuff we hear every day.
Deja vu.
Mark Hertzgard, who was the executive editor of the Times until 1988, reported that Abe Rosenthal suppressed the Iran-Contra story for a year before it broke in 1986 because he supported Ronald Reagan.
I don't believe that.
You don't think that's true?
No, I don't. But I mean, I've been down there in the newsroom, and I've represented all forms of media all my life, probably every place in New York. And, you know, the press has its own autonomous identity. And if you try to tell somebody to do something because of a political reason, whether it's a reporter or an editor, I mean, in old-fashioned media, which is still here, by the way, that doesn't happen, I don't think.
Well, Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg, has been critical of the media's, including the New York Times' handling of the Iraq War, of drones, of the Obama administration's policy of indefinite detentions and whistleblowers. Do you share any of his concerns?
Oh, I share some of his concerns. I do. I mean, I think there's an interesting comparison between drones that Obama has dealt with and with the press. In each case, you're dealing with a loss of human rights. And in drones, for example, Obama now has dialed it back, which is what he should have done. He's made noises that he's going to dial it back with his press relations, but I don't believe what he's saying. And furthermore, I think this Rosen precedent, how can you dial back the precedent? I mean, you can tell future generations of presidents, don't use the drones the way I did. I was trying to learn them, and I think they'll pay attention. But that darn Rosen case is sitting there.
Well, what tools or means does the government have today that weren't available to Nixon to coerce or to nudge the press or to keep the things secret without people ever knowing that something is being kept secret?
What tools do they have? Well, I think the major tool they have in this whole battle is the tools that are available to investigators, use a fancy word here, in the digital age, because
they can go after your email.
Yeah, because you leave digital tracks no matter where you go. So if you have a meeting with somebody in a supermarket and you buy something, you were there at the supermarket. So the government's got a lot of power over you, and by the way, without doing what they did with Rosen.
James C. Goodell, his book, Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. It's published by CUNY Journalism Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks a lot, Len. Like being here.